from KALW News in San Francisco. This is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in San Francisco in the Glen Park area.
Sunset, Portola Valley.
I currently reside in Nob Hill.
West Portal.
I live in Russian Hill.
Coming up, we'll listen in on a conversation between local Palestinians and Jews.
I think it is tragic because these people creating so much violence are my people.
Then Bay Area Jews head to the desert to reclaim their biblical roots.
I had to learn the ancient traditions. I had to learn the ancient language. I had to begin to understand like what our ancestors had passed down to me.
And an Oakland filmmaker tells us the tragic but hopeful story of the Muslim farming community of Yuba City.
Closure for the community came in rebuilding the mosque.
California Believers, today on Cross Currents. Stay with us. The daily news of violence from the Gaza Strip is gripping people around the world. Here in the Bay Area, hundreds gathered in downtown San Francisco over the weekend, calling for an end to an Israeli military incursion that's so far killed more than 600 people, most of them civilians. Meanwhile, Jewish organizations around the Bay gathered to stand in solidarity with what they see as Israel's right to defend itself against Palestinian rocket fire. It's perhaps not surprising that the conflicts that divide the Middle East would play out here in California. But it's not that way for everyone. For the past 16 years, the San Francisco chapter of the Jewish-Palestinian Living Room Dialogue has gathered under one roof. The group has included Israelis and Holocaust survivors, Palestinians exiled after the 1948 founding of Israel, and more recent immigrants from Gaza and the West Bank. Together, they debate the politics and mourn the bloodshed. It can get heated at times, but the group mantra is always to listen. Michael Bernstein, a Jewish American, and Melek Nasser Toda, a Palestinian American, were at a recent dialogue. Here's what they had to say.
My father was very Arab. He had a big nose and a very thick accent. The story of my dad coming to the United States is in 1948, he fled with his family. They were from Haifa. They had a big home there. As I was growing up, you know, I don't know that he ever said the Jewish people are evil, but I mean, it was essentially that was sort of the idea.
I was born in San Francisco. I have a great affinity towards the Jewish community in general and in San Francisco in particular. I got involved with the group about 13 years ago. It gave me a safe place to go to express my opinions, which are sometimes unpopular in the Jewish community. I'm Jewish. It gives me an insight into people's real lives, particularly people who are from Palestine or from Gaza or from the West Bank.
It was more for me to calm my inner demons or whatever and not have so much anger, right, about Jewish people and the conflict. I felt like I really wanted to understand the hardship that the Jewish people went through in terms of the pogroms and the Holocaust and, you know, then coming into Israel.
I have a kinship to my Jewish family in Israel. However, I also have feelings for other human beings. I think it is tragic because these people creating so much violence are my people.
I don't feel like I'm on the Palestinian side and somebody else is on the Jewish side. I don't feel like that at all. I feel like I'm on both sides. You know, I think what you learn is that nothing's black and white. Everything is gray. Everybody has their own perception and perspective, and you really have to, you know, be able to listen, you know, and you don't have to judge. You can just listen.
What I have learned from this group is the importance of trying to be calm and listen when I may be diametrically opposed to that point of view and might even be repulsed by that point of view.
What's nice about the dialogue group is you really can bring two people together who hate each other. They've never met each other, but they hate each other. And if you get them to learn about each other and know each other and have a connection, they might like each other. And it's hard to hate somebody you like.
That was Michael Bernstein and Melek Nasser Toda. KLW's Judy Silber produced that piece. So how do you think people on different sides of a conflict can start a dialogue? Let us know. Leave us a message on our feedback line. It's 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. We're starting a new series here on the show that will explore stories about innovation in belief, belonging, and religious practice. We call it The Spiritual Edge.
I'm a Muslim.
I am a Jewish.
I have no religion.
I'm Christian.
Reform Judaism.
I'm Catholic.
Muslim.
Not religious.
Buddhist.
Southern Baptist.
Hindu. Atheist.
Christian.
Agnostic.
Catholic.
Our first story in the series starts with a question. Are American Jews having an identity crisis? That's what a Pew Research study from late last year seems to show. It found more people who, though born Jewish, don't really identify with their religion. What the Pew Report didn't capture is a reverse trend, people turning back toward their religious roots. Innovative organizations are popping up all around the country. Jewish after-school programs, Jewish farms, Jewish LGBTQ and environmental groups, all building bridges between ancient and contemporary cultures. KLW's Judy Silber was intrigued by the idea of exploring her own Jewish heritage in a more modern way. She brings us this story about one Berkeley-based organization that's bringing Judaism's ancient teachings to life.
I'm Jewish. I feel a strong affinity for Judaism, the beauty of its rituals, teachings, and music. And it can be hard to relate. The Old Testament has a demanding God and strange customs, like animal sacrifices. And then there's Jewish law called halakha with its crazy complicated rules about how to run your life, what foods you can or cannot eat, what clothes you can or cannot wear, and how you observe the holidays. This past spring, I tagged along with Wilderness Torah, one group that's trying to bring new meaning to the old tradition. Passover is one of the most important holidays on the Jewish calendar. Traditionally, you tell the story of the Israelites' liberation from slavery in Egypt over an elaborate family meal. Wilderness Torah takes the story to the desert.
Hey, welcome! You're here! You made it! Out of Egypt! Ready for some liberation?
Woo. About 150 people are gathering in a remote spot called Panamint Valley, 8 hours south of the Bay Area. As we arrive, a warm wind swirls dust in our faces. A friendly woman in her 30s dabs our foreheads with a wet cloth.
It is hot, like really hot.
The desert feels big and suffocating. I think of the Israelites and the Passover story. In Egypt, they were slaves. With the help of God, Moses, and a few miracles, they escaped, crossing the Red Sea into the desert. Then they got scared and wanted to turn back.
This song is to inform you of some hazards that exist on this land.
Rattlesnakes, black widows, spiders, and scorpions.
Rattlesnakes, spiders, and scorpions. It's easy to see why they wanted to go back.
So really, Wilderness Torah is a project of remembering.
Zelig Golden is the founding director of Wilderness Torah.
It's a project of remembering something very, very ancient about being an ancient indigenous people while contextualizing that for our modern time.
A decade ago, Golden was an environmental lawyer. Like many American Jewish kids, after his bar mitzvah, he became less involved with Judaism. But then at 30, something changed.
I caught fire. And all of a sudden, I had to learn the ancient traditions. I had to learn the ancient language. I had to begin to understand like what our ancestors had passed down to me.
Golden was also interested in Native American traditions. He went on a 3-day vision quest in 2007. There, he says, he heard a message. Reconnect your people to the natural world. Not too long after, he organized the first Wilderness Torah festival.
Within the sacred text are embedded powerful lessons about how to relate to each other, how to relate to the earth, and how to walk in a sacred manner on this planet.
All around us in the desert are signs that this is a uniquely Jewish experience, like the kosher food and Hebrew words tossed casually into conversation. Or that big sound, which comes from an ancient instrument called a shofar, made from the long, curved horn of a ram.
Elders and families, please eat first.
Dinner in the desert is held in a large, open-air tent decorated with colorful tapestries. As we eat, I look around. The people here are a smorgasbord of Jews. People who grew up Reform, Conservative, Orthodox, or nothing at all. Some go to synagogue or keep kosher, and some don't. Wilderness Torah attracts a lot of young people in their 20s and 30s, earthy hippie types. But there are others in their 40s and 50s, and families drawn to the special programming for teenagers and kids. I talked to the Yusim family, originally from Ukraine, now living in San Jose. Andy Yusim is 8 years old.
Can you tell me about your connection to Judaism? Do you feel Jewish?
I don't know what it means.
You don't know what it means to be Jewish?
I know what it means to be Jewish, but I don't know what Judaism means.
Like many ethnic groups, the strands of Jewish culture are growing weaker through the generations. Andy's mom, Irene, says that's why they're in the desert. She wants her children to know their heritage.
You know, I don't want them to grow up and say, Mom, you didn't tell me I was Jewish. You didn't tell me, you know, we have traditions and holidays. So I'm doing what I can. I don't know a whole lot myself, but I want them to know that this is what it is. And there are all kinds of people who celebrate it in all kinds of ways.
Throughout the festival, I ask people about their relationship to Judaism. Many tell me they feel connected, but they also struggle.
I don't really know how to define my relationship to Judaism.
I wrestle with ideas of God.
A lot of the people in my family didn't believe in God, but they said, you must follow religion, but there was no meaning to it for me, and I found that hard.
You know, reading the text in synagogue, yeah, it didn't really have, like, a lot of connection to my daily life.
I do not like the patriarchal aggression that happens towards the repression of women.
The conflict also is like the other parts of you, you know, being American, being other interests, other passions.
So I sort of went, yeah, and left it all and married a Catholic and just went away. But I still felt I missed some sense of belonging that I needed.
Friday, my second day in the desert, I talk with Jacqueline Marks in the early morning.
It was wonderful waking up this morning. I slept really without a sleeping bag. It was so warm, and I woke up to the sun rising and to some music and a few people shuffling around, and it was very peaceful. So our tent is right next to this beautiful mountain range, and it's black and red and white, and it's a very unique spot to be camping.
In the afternoon, I meet someone with special insight on the significance of the desert in Jewish tradition.
I'm Ted Ryder, and I'm a rabbi.
Ryder is off duty now, a Jewish seeker in the desert just like the rest of us. I still ask for his wisdom. He says the desert is a raw and empty place where transformation is possible.
You know, Moses was out in the desert. Elijah was out in the desert. In the Christian tradition, Jesus was out in the desert for days and days. It was there that they found the answers to questions maybe they weren't even asking.
Saturday is Shabbat, the Sabbath, the day of rest. Traditionally, people pray and study at the synagogue. We gather in the meeting tent. We sing songs and say Hebrew prayers and read from a Torah that survived the Holocaust, though its original owners did not. Its presence brings up what some people say they think about a lot. They feel responsible to ancestors who suffered or died for their faith. An irony is clear. Today, American Jews are free to practice without fear, perhaps more so than any other time in history. And yet, precisely because there is so much freedom, It requires a deliberate choice to stay involved. After the service, Wilderness Torah director Zelig Golden tells us each of us will go into the desert by ourselves. We will stake out an isolated spot and sit there for a few hours. We've talked a lot about the Passover story. Golden says it's now time to embody it.
There is some mystery here. You go out to be in the land by yourself, and, you know, it might just be a nice walk in the sunshine, in the wind. And, you know, it might be a lot more.
I walk northeast for a ways. Sitting by a creosote bush, I crumple desert dirt in my hands, pick up a rock, look up at the vast sky, and ponder the questions of my life. No ready answers come, but I feel joy. The desert is special. It's quiet.
So I'd love to hear from perhaps a few of you, just like a word or a phrase from what you brought back from your wilderness encounter. Anyone?
Just listen.
Be like the wind.
Call for what you want, even if you don't know who's listening.
Get down on the ground.
Stand on your head.
In celebration, the group sings and dances for hours. The late night moon is rising when I sit down with Jacqueline Marks again.
What I love about Wilderness Torah and these types of immersive retreats is they're full of so much song and music and prayer and teaching. And I think there's a lot of magic that happens here. I have not found such a deep spiritual connection to Judaism and to God in other places.
For this chant, we're going to have a moment of silence in the chant, and during that beat, I want you to listen to the heartbeat of the earth. Shema Yisrael Adonai Eloheinu
Adonai Echad. In the morning, I will return to the Bay Area, happily connected to my heritage and ethnic birthright. It's a powerful feeling, knowing that among 7 billion people on the planet, you belong somewhere. For Cross Currents, I'm Judy Silber.
Stay tuned to Cross Currents for more stories about innovation in belief, belonging, and practice from the Spiritual Edge. You can also find them all at spiritualedge.org. And while you're over there, leave a suggestion in the comments of what you'd like to hear. Shema Israel, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad.
You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. And now on to another religious community in California, Muslims. The Bay Area is home to 250,000 Muslims. They work in tech, medicine, commerce, the service industry. And if you drive 2 hours north of San Francisco to Yuba City, you'll find a Muslim farming community that's been there for nearly a century. Pakistani immigrants made their way to Yuba City in the 1920s, and they grow almonds, alfalfa, and prunes, lots of prunes. The community was living peacefully until one fateful day in 1994, when disaster struck. Oakland filmmaker David Washburn's new film, An American Mosque, tells their story. I talked to Washburn and first asked him to tell me more about the Pakistani farming community of Yuba City.
Like other immigrants from South Asia, they came down, some of them, you know, back in the turn of the 20th century, via work in the railroads, via work in farm labor camps, and ended up settling in Yuba City. One of the main characters in the film, his name is Khalid Saeed. His grandfather was a kind of a pioneer of the community, a farm laborer, and then ultimately with his brother decided to purchase land where the mosque now stands. For me, when I learned this story of here's this group of multi-generational Muslim Americans who are farming, and then deciding to convert this farmland into, you know, a house of worship. This is the kind of, you know, little home on the prairie type mythology that we share with one another, and here it is in a Muslim context. So I thought that was absolutely something I wanted to bring forward.
So what happens? This community in Yuba City builds their mosque. What then happens?
It was a functioning mosque. People were praying in it. There had been marriages in it. Just before its completion, two individuals went in late at night with gasoline. They took what were rolled up carpets that had been put on the floor for prostration for prayer. They moved those into a section of the mosque, doused them with gasoline, and lit the mosque on fire. And this huge blaze occurred, reducing the mosque to ashes by the morning.
What happened then when the community came the next morning and found the mosque had been burned down?
They really didn't know what to do, honestly. I mean, this is something that people were unprepared for. You know, here in a farm town in Yuba City, they were not prepared to, let's say, hold a press conference. They didn't have the kind of experience with how do we rally support to put collective pressure on investigators to put as much labor and work and investigative power into solving this crime.
And so, as you mentioned, kind of one of the main people that we see throughout this film is Khalid Said. And he says something really poignant at one point. Let's listen to him.
How American do I have to be an American? My children here, they're grown up. Their children, they're born here. My father is buried here. My grandfather is buried here. There's five, six generation going on. That was the thinking in our minds that we're like neighbors.
What does that mean to you, him saying that?
It means several things to me. Visually, he's saying this as he's has his trucker cap on, has a cigarette out of his mouth, and he's driving a flatbed pickup truck full of prunes on his farm. And so visually, there's a kind of irony that's going on there that I hope viewers notice, that here's this person saying this, and yet here is almost like an image off of a Marlboro commercial, you know? But personally, I think it represents a lot in the sense that why are people having to continually ask this, even after generations of being here? And so when he says that, for me, it's kind of important to kind of, almost in a provocative way, suggest you don't consider me American, you know? Prove to me how I'm less American than you are.
Was this ruled to be a hate crime, or what happened?
As far as I'm concerned, as the filmmaker and the storyteller, I deem this as a hate crime. Members of the Muslim community at the time deemed it as a hate crime. Investigators, you know, investigated it as if it were a hate crime to a degree. This was a different moment in time where, you know, yeah, the word Islamophobia was not something that even the investigator would know. And so this reflects a kind of a pre-9/11 moment, but it also shows that this kind of ignorance was happening back then.
What kind of responses came from the non-Muslim community, the churches?
I tracked down a number of individuals who wrote letters and had them read these letters for the first time almost 20 years after the event happened. These people hadn't seen the letters in over a decade, and they read the letter for my camera, and you see, you know, the tears that occur when these people, Christian, Quakers, Presbyterians, reading these letters and, you know, expressing their kind of solidarity as American to American with Muslims that were affected in Yuba City. It's a very powerful moment.
Let's take a listen.
My wife and I were shocked last week to drive by on Tierra Buena to see the burned out center.
Like so many others, we were shocked and saddened to hear about the destruction of your mosque.
We know the work and love that goes into building that insurance can never pay back.
This small contribution toward its rebuilding comes from those of us. I'm really saddened as I remember this.
The case wasn't solved, and they just closed the case. So I'm wondering, as you were speaking with the people of Yuba City, the Muslims of Yuba City, did they find closure?
The way the characters and the community members responded was not through violent means, but was through peaceful resiliency. Closure for the community came in rebuilding the mosque. In some ways, this film represents a bit of a healing process for the community there, the characters in the film. That, to me, is very important, that they find some kind of healing in having this film out there and having others learn about this story.
That's Oakland filmmaker David Washburn. His film, An American Mosque, aired on PBS stations nationwide, and you can see it online until July 28th. We have the link for you at klw.org. Just click on Cross Currents. And that does it for today's edition of Cross Currents from KALW News. The team includes Lawrence Chan, Leela Day, Jeannie Dwan, Chris Hoff, Suki Lewis, Holly J. McDeed, Ted Muldoon, Rachel Vasquez, and Stephen Short. Today's show is engineered by Seth Samuel. Our line producer was Audrey Dilling. Senior producers are Julie Kane and Jen Chien. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Holly Kernan is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. And thank you. We're listener-supported public radio. This music is by a quartet called Gajogo from Berkeley. They're performing Thursday night at the Center for New Music in San Francisco. Show starts at 7:30. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.